This podcast features three supposed adults who definitely use adult language. They're also supposedly writers who are definitely not procrastinating by making this podcast. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to No Bad Ideas, the storytelling game show where we take the worst ideas from the internet and try to turn them into stories that are actually good.
My name is Gabriel Urbina, and I am your first Bad Ideas co-host.
My name is Sarah Shackett. I am your second Bad Ideas co-host.
And I am lucky number three, Zach Valenti, your third Bad Ideas co-host.
And today we have the honor and the privilege of having a guest with us in the studio. We are joined by author of Tinfoil Crown and professor Aaron Jones. How are you doing today?
Hello, I'm so good. I'm so excited to be here.
We're so excited to have you.
This is great. I'm okay. Yeah, I'm ready.
All right.
I'm nervous, but I'm ready.
Well, that is basically the way to be here at No Bad Ideas. But before we dive in, so you're now in the process of promoting your book. How's that going?
Yes, it's been good. It's kind of a weird process because you spend so much time like working on something by yourself in like sitting at my desk in my studio apartment writing this book. And now I kind of have to try to get it out to like everyone. I'm like, this was my little thing for like so long. And now it's a lot different. It's been exciting. Like everyone has been very, very excited about it and like very supportive. But it's weird. It's like a weird switch from writing to promoting. So
I can imagine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you want to tell us kind of the 500 words or less version of what the book's about?
Sure. So Tinfoil Crowns is a young adult novel about a 17-year-old YouTube star named Fit. And the story kind of starts off with her mother coming back into her life. Her mother hasn't been in her life for about like 14 years because when Fit was like three, her mom, suffering from postpartum psychosis, tried to harm her. And so they were separated. Mm-hmm. And so now the book is taking place when Fit is like starting to become this YouTube star, starting to get into like this weird internet celebrity culture. Mm. And then her mom comes back into her life. So it is about like the internet culture, all of that. But at its heart, it's like a story of family and kind of like trauma. So
wow.
Yeah.
Amazing. Very relevant.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's weird to like, it's a young adult novel, but it's pretty heavy. I started writing it not as a young adult novel. I didn't think it was going to be, but then it was suggested like, oh, she's 17 and it's about the internet. So it's for teenagers. But it does deal with a lot of like heavy, heavy stuff. So yeah.
Awesome.
That sounds very amazing. Cool.
Thank you.
Well, everybody should go check out Tinfoil Crowns.
Yes.
But they should do that like 45 minutes into the future. First, they should listen to the rest of this episode of No Bad Ideas.
Exactly. Exactly.
For anyone who is joining us for the first time ever here at No Bad Ideas, what we do is we find stories that represent the worst ideas that humanity has ever had. The
nadir, really.
Yes, the... Yeah.
Brace yourselves.
The misguided, the greedy, the just... absolutely absurd. And we bring these stories in, and only the person that is bringing the story has ever seen or heard it before. And after they present it, everyone else has, in today's case, 15 minutes to try to come up with a pitch for how this might be turned into a good story. And I am particularly excited today because I get to go first with my bad idea. So are you guys ready for bad idea number one?
All right, let's do it.
I can't wait.
So this story comes to us from NPR News. There's going to be a link in the description in case anyone wants to read along. I think that I'm going to jump right into the article with this one.
And the headline reveal later?
Exactly.
All right.
Yes. Just remind me if I get overexcited and I don't say what the headline is to actually say it at the end of the article.
Copy.
So here we go. It's a milestone so common that it has become a Hollywood trope. The son packs his things, carries all those vestiges of his former life across the threshold of the front door, and, with the unwavering encouragement of his parents, finally leaves their home to face the wider world. It's a little less common for that son to be 30 years old, and still less common for his parents' quote-unquote encouragement to take the form of a court order. But here damn. We are.
Oh, dear. This is a millennial mood.
Oh. Ouch.
Michael Rotondo, the man evicted after months of wrangling with his parents, complied Friday with the ruling that a county Supreme Court justice handed down last week. Local media report he left his house in Camillus, New York, just 4 hours before his high noon deadline to depart.
Woof.
Man.
Then he came back to grab a few more things. But he did leave again, this time with 2.5 hours to spare. And this time with the aging car that had become a focal point in the roughly half dozen messages his parents wrote him before going to court. The hatchback got a little help from some jumper cables, and Rotondo offered the members of the media gathered outside a tasteful honk of the horn before leaving the block.
Was there media there?
I think that because this has just been sort of like such a big case for this particular community, just like an ongoing media circus of these parents trying to get their son to leave the house. The honk lent a valedictory note to what had become a winding saga that NPR's Bill Chappell recounted last week. First, in October, there were the informal discussions about leaving the house. So far, so good. Then, beginning in February, there were the notes that escalated from a little financial motivation to formal orders to leave. And finally, after an original 30-day deadline lapsed, there was an official confrontation in court.
Wow.
Rotondo argued that he had the right to stick around a while longer. His parents said it was time to go. And ultimately, Onondaga County Supreme Court Justice Donald Greenwood sided with Rotondo's mother and father. Quote, "You say you're entitled to 6 months. To 6 months, which really seems to be kind of outrageous," Greenwood said, "that somebody in this day and age could be in somebody else's home with a 6-month notice before they have to leave." Conclusive as it was, that decision didn't quite resolve the friction. Gee, I wonder why. Shortly after the ruling was rendered, international media took notice, and so did the writers of think pieces and comment board diatribes everywhere.
Oh, no.
My sympathy just switched. The word, quote, millennial got some good exercise.
Yeah.
And suddenly, other Michael Rotondos got caught in the crossfire, including one who also happens to hail from central New York in Albany. Quote, "Being from upstate New York with the same spelling of the name, being the same age, and basically actually very coincidentally happened to be looking for a place."
Holy shit.
"This has been a crazy, crazy ride," the other Rotondo
told
CNYC Central on Thursday.
You can't make that shit up.
Quote, "I am not getting sued by my parents. I love my parents," he said, adding once more for good measure, "Again, I have not been sued by my parents."
Oh my lord.
That's hilarious.
The week went no more smoothly for Rotondo or his parents. The publication reports that a stranger called him on the phone with just a single word, "loser," before hanging up, prompting Rotondo to call 911. But it wasn't the only 911 call placed this week by Rotondo, who reportedly lost visitation rights to his own child last year.
Woof.
Whoa, he's not having a good time.
But that is all in the rearview mirror. For now, Rotondo says he is off to an Airbnb. Quote, "It's great not to have to be here anymore," he said outside his parents' garage on Thursday. Asked whether that marks a dramatic change in his thinking given his recent hard-fought court battle, Rotondo answered succinctly, "Sort of." So.
Wow, that was a roller coaster of emotion.
There's a lot in there.
Good
catch, Gabrielle.
I'm glad that you guys think so.
There were a lot of twists and turns in there.
Oh, yes.
That was great.
So 15 minutes on the clock starting now. Tell me how we turned this into a good story.
I mean, the thing that I think caught my ear, because Failure to Launch is a bad movie, but it exists.
But it might not be a bad concept, even though it's a bad movie.
That's fair.
Remind me the
premise?
That is the Matthew McConaughey, Sarah Jessica Parker. He is
He's
a guy
basement.
In his 30s, and then someone has is apparently makes a living out of getting people to leave their parents' home. And so she's hired to do that, and then they fall in love.
I see.
But what caught my ear was the sort of collateral, like the friendly fire of like the other,
the
Michael,
other Michael Rotundo.
That I loved. Yeah, the double Rotundo.
Just to just be like, I love my parents. Yeah. I'm not getting sued by my parents.
And so, like,
everybody
there
on
is,
Facebook, please stop attacking me.
Right. So I think there is maybe like a fascinating story that hasn't really existed of someone sort of getting caught up in like the social media crossfire of this, of a very, you know, sort of explosive, controversial event. That is what occurred to me, but I'm curious what you two are thinking about.
When I was listening to it, I was wondering with like a story like this, are you going to start at the beginning of when the, when he's living in the house, or does it start when he has already left the house? Kind of what he does now after his parents have evicted him. I don't really know how you come back from that, really. So would it be like a redemption story or a story of like family strife as they are trying to evict their 30-year-old son, which like that's not that well, okay.
No, but it's true that I think that really impacts kind of audience sympathy. Mm-hmm. If you're kind of watching something where at the beginning he's just kind of this guy that's out in his luck living at home, and you see like day after day nothing is going his way, and then suddenly his parents are kind of going, you gotta go, get out.
Yeah.
You're just kind of like, oh my god, this poor guy, these parents are so tyrannical and awful, my god. But if instead you're sort of starting with like the first scene is in the courthouse and the judge is kind of going, for god's sakes, these people are telling you to get out of their home.
Yeah.
I think that you'd probably be much more in camp parents of get out of their home, leave.
Right.
Yeah.
I am a little bit absorbed in the potential reality show of Michael versus Michael.
Yes.
Where they force them to move in together.
No.
Is there a way that we can bring them together somehow?
Right. Like, is there a world where they like, and it's like them against the world, or like they're in some kind of like get your life together competition?
Mm-hmm.
Or it could be like a dual story with like we
right.
see
the rise and fall.
Yes,
of,
like
yeah.
we see both Michaels as they're traverse, like, and somehow
right.
they were brought together by this weird this weird thing.
I love the idea of maybe it starts with the wrong Michael waking up to a media circus outside of his apartment. He's just like, what is going on?
And he gets out there and everyone is going, why do you hate your parents? Why do you hate your parents? Tells everything. He's just kind of like,
like mom, and like he's like, you know, goes to his mom and dad's room, like, what's going on? And they're just confused. Like, I don't know, honey.
Either that or they're angry too. They're kind of like, don't come in here with that after what you said last night. And he's kind of like, what did I say?
Yeah. And then, I mean, there is maybe sort of an angle where if like the sort of paparazzi storm on the mistaken Michael is big enough, he can be like, you know what? Screw everyone. I'm going to let that guy live in my place. Like,
oh man. So they,
oh,
so
wow.
the other Rotunda family adopts the one that
yeah.
gets kicked out. I love it.
Right.
Oh, it's so weird.
That it. And so if he does then live there, is it going to work out or?
That is,
no.
I have a feeling that there's probably a reason why,
yes.
like, his parents were willing to go to court to evict him as,
right.
Yes, because is he this basement dweller?
Right.
I mean, no offense, we're in a basement.
Hey, I take no offense. I'm told it's garden level.
Is he, like, a basement dweller, like, just playing video games all day? Or
right.
is he, does he have, like, $300,000 in student loans and he
yeah.
can't?
Yeah. And he used to kind of work for this startup that was
yes.
trying to do an ethical alternative
right.
to a big bad company,
right,
but
right,
they
right.
ran out of funding. And since then, he hasn't been able to kind of get another job.
Right.
right.
He like took a big gamble on like some sort of startup or like a creative risk, and it didn't pan out. And now he's just like, well, I have no marketable skills.
Right. Like, I guess, like, is this the tale of an American freeloader, or is this the tale of somebody who got the bad end of circumstances?
Right.
And I think related to that is sort of the question of, is this Kramer versus Kramer, or is this Kramer from Seinfeld?
Right.
I mean, sort of like, is this a heavy, kind of heady family drama, or is it sort of just kind of a wacky sitcom about...
I could see it being in the vein of like Little Miss Sunshine, or where it does have this like heaviness to it, but it's still just, there are some very absurd, wonderful moments in it.
It's like it bubbles with
That's
sort
a good
of a charm.
Yeah, yeah. Because then if he is down on his luck and his parents then do kick him out, that makes them kind of, we don't like them that much. But if he is just not doing anything with his life, it's like we understand the parents. So I think that that also will play into like the family dynamic of it.
I got it. He was making macaroni paintings of Grumpy Cat, and he had like a flash in the pan success on Instagram as an artist.
Oh my God.
And his 15 minutes of fame are over and his parents are over, are done with him because he's just not responded well. The depression of, you know, coming out of having everybody's attention to being now, you know, sort of broken.
And he keeps trying to like find the next thing that he's going to do. And
that
he's
he can
like,
do macaroni art for.
Or just like the next like internet sensation of like, what can he do to continue to be like viral or something like that.
Right.
And it just isn't working out. Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
And then you get that person into like a new environment with people who are not versed in sort of like don't have Instagram accounts or you know, aren't sort of seeing the value of that. And then you can have sort of an exchange about like, well, okay, but you need to be here. And like, if we're all having dinner together, you need to interact with us.
So this is the new family?
Yeah, no, assuming that it's still that concept of like this guy gets very publicly shamed and kicked out of his parents.
It's the next thing to go viral since his successful
art. That's true. And then when the new guy is just like, hey, do you need a break? And then you can have sort of Michael number one wanting to try and like keep the publicity and the viral stuff going, when Michael number two's intention was just like, let me give you like some privacy.
He's using this Michael and Michael situation to get this internet fame.
Absolutely.
He's like, oh, follow me, follow along with this journey as I now become this new member of this family.
Right. Oh my God. It's so weird.
Maybe they're not into it. Maybe they're...
There's like, honey, is something wrong with the internet? I think our new Michael's live streaming still.
He's on Twitch.
He's on Twitch, yeah.
Well, and you know what would probably kind of be an interesting dynamic to explore? Because I'm now kind of seeing a little bit how the six people in this story might start to fit together. There might be sort of an element of, so let me make sure that we're getting the nomenclature straight. Michael number one is the one that was getting kicked out of
his
house.
Let's call him Instagram Michael.
Okay, so Insta Michael.
Mikey Fresh.
Mikey Fresh is getting...
Yeah, what's his handle?
It's probably Mikey Fresh.
Yeah. But like Mikey Fresh 69 or something.
I was just thinking that. Nice. It has to be said.
Oh, God.
Nice.
So Mikey Fresh and his fly Instagram account get kicked out of his parents' house. And then Michael gives him a place to stay, correct?
Right. Yeah.
There might be a sort of an interesting dynamic if, you know, when Mikey Fresh starts kind of playing up the media circus, Michael starts turning to his parents and kind of going like, I am so sorry. Like, you know, this is like, I did not know like what we were signing up for.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And his parents are kind of actually like, oh no, we think it's fun. It's kind of awesome.
This is kind of neat.
And there's so different.
And there starts to sort of be this kind of like, you know, you start to kind of realize like, oh, hang on a second. Mikey Fresh might actually fit in quite well with Michael's parents.
And Michael might actually fit
in really well with Mikey Fresh's parents.
So do they end up switching?
I think that the sort of like ultimate thing needs to kind of be this. No, there's kind of a very surface level similarity and simpatico between them. But really kind of deep down, mm-hmm. everyone is actually sort of both like the product and the complement to the people that they were actually raised by. But I think that that is kind of like the sort of long conclusion that you get at.
Right. After you know, three acts of conflict.
Yes. Right, yeah. Right, right.
And parent swap.
Parent swap. I love it.
So fun. And he could get like sponsors and like weird stuff that he's like posting like sponsored content for. Yeah.
Right, right.
And he's getting like all Michael the ones just like, we've been having a lot of Kick cereal lately. And Michael too's like, can you say that again? But just like 1 second, let me just angle. Okay, great. Now go.
Right. And Michael's parents are just like, we love all the free stuff. Like, you know, like, this is awesome.
We're saving so much money.
Yeah.
So is Insta Michael 69, is he going to change at the end, or
for God's sakes, yes.
Yes, no.
Please,
how?
Lord.
Very much so.
How?
Gets how a flip phone.
No,
that's too superficial.
I think maybe the thing is to channel his energies for not himself, and like he becomes the social media manager for like
a local
the museum that is
And he needs to kind of find something that he enjoys doing, because the doing of the thing itself is meaningful.
Yes. Not the feedback.
Even if it takes years to come to fruition.
Yeah.
Instead of kind of chasing the thing that is going to be like an immediate overnight success, and only doing it for the immediate overnight success.
Right.
And maybe it could be just making paintings out of macaroni. Like that was his like real thing that he loved doing. And
he's only done it to unwind. Like, it's only been sort of something that
he brings it to the senior home or something.
Oh.
Yeah.
I quite like that.
And starts doing, like, social media management for, like, the partnership company that, like, pairs seniors up with younger people so that they can have conversations and stuff. Yeah. I like that.
Very, very good. Very good. Okay. So you have 2.5 minutes left.
Ooh.
Let's see if we can kind of nail down some more aspects about this. So how do things escalate? Like kind of, so you end up in this situation where Michael's family is now kind of having to deal with the media circus. His parents are kind of into it. He's really not. Mikey Fresh is just kind of being Mikey Fresh, and he's not being able to get through to him at all. He sort of, you know, in desperation turns to Mikey Fresh's parents and find them just like, oh, what a nice couple. The tea time at their house is so nice and quiet and civil. And he's kind of like really relating to them. How do things go from there? Like, sort of like, what is the thing that happens that kicks it up?
He starts vlogging.
Yeah.
About his miserable new fake brother.
Michael?
Yeah.
Oh, and he like suddenly gets like,
Michael's just like, I've had it and nobody in my home will listen to me and I don't have the
and
money
the
for
the outrage
a therapist.
Blog goes crazy viral.
Right, it's so authentic.
And it beats and it beats Mikey Fresh's.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's jealous.
Oh my God.
He starts to do these like long live streams that is just like him and Mikey Fresh's parents having tea in absolute silence for an hour, and everyone on the internet is just like, it's so meditative and awesome. Just like kind of, you know, just like really
at
sort of
23 minutes, the cat walks across the window and it's just magical.
And well, there's also going to be people probably reaching out to Insta Michael because like they want the clout. They they want this. And so he'll think that he is becoming like these are real connections maybe, but then he's realizing that, oh, like his real connections are actually with this like new fake family. And also maybe with his older family.
His actual
too.
Parents.
Yeah.
Right, right.
Is the ones that evicted him.
Wow.
It could come out that like perhaps, you know, this is not the case in the real scenario, that perhaps Instamike did certain things in order to push his parents over the edge into evicting him.
Sure.
And like that is sort of the thing that he needs to apologize to them for, is that he is partly responsible for like the media circus around the story of himself.
In the last couple of seconds, what is this called?
Oh.
I mean, I really parents like the parents.
Parent swap.
Parents are
like
I was,
and subscribe. Double
like,
tap.
Hey, double tap. I like that.
All right, and that is time. Well done, everybody. I completely forgot to do this earlier, so let me actually now read what the headline is now that we've gone through it. The headline is 30-year-old leaves the nest after parents win court-ordered eviction.
Oh.
Ouch. I hope you've landed in a comfortable place, Michael.
Indeed.
It's an article from
Michael. I hope you're no longer getting harassed by people who may think that you are the other Michael.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what's the wildest thing about this for me? It's kind of the person that actually called the Michael and just sort of that like loser.
Yeah.
And hung
up. Like, what are you, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. Get back to fucking running the country.
So this article is, thanks.
Sorry.
took me a moment.
I did have that thought in the middle of this. Like, there is some poor soul.
There's one person
who's named John
of.
Bolton. And it's not the one with the mustache.
Yeah. It is an article from June of 2018. So hopefully by now, everyone's lives have kind of quieted down and everyone has landed on their feet.
Yeah.
And, well, we will hopefully land on our feet at some point in this next break, and we'll see you on the other side.
Hey, y'all. Breaking into the episode for just a moment to let you know about an exciting thing that is happening right now. Gabrielle, Zach, and I are, in addition to making No Bad Ideas, working on another podcast series that's going to be out later this month. It's called 0 Hours. It stars just some ridiculous, amazing people from the world of audio drama. People like Priggins Snow, people like Ellen Winter, people like Peter Coleman of Time Bombs. All of our deep audio drama crushes have said yes to this. We think it's going to be really cool. We're really excited about the stories we're telling. And if you would like to help us make this series as we are in the final stretches of editing it, head to zerohourspodcast.com, zerohourspodcast.com. And there you can sign up for updates about the series and also to help buy us a coffee, which, dear Lord, we need. and if you would like to support us long term so that we can make other cool anthology shows like this, the place to do that is our Patreon. Head to nobadideaspodcast.com/support. Again, that's nobadideaspodcast.com/support. Throw us a couple bucks every month. It really helps us make this show, make 0 Hours, hopefully make a bunch of other shows in the new year. We really, really appreciate it. We can't do this without the support that y'all have given us. So thank you, thank you, thank you. If you already support us on Patreon, if you can't, that's totally okay. We love you anyway. Listening to shows like No Bad Ideas also really helps us. And so we will just step aside and let you get back to listening to this episode right now. Another round of No Bad Ideas with our fantastic guest, Aaron Jones.
Hello.
I have this one.
Oh, no.
And I am going to read the headline.
Oh, God.
Yay.
And it comes to us as well from NPR as well, from the archives.
The
of
masters of the of
the
weird.
The strange news section. Yes. I mean, you can't improve on perfection. So I'm just going to read this and then you all will have 15 minutes. To discuss it. And listeners, if you would like to read along, then a link for this is in the description of the show. So, I'm so excited for all of you.
The more she says that, the more worried we get. We're just like holding my breath. Like,
this article is called The Poop Trains.
No.
Reign of Terror.
Oh my God.
In small town Alabama has ended.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad.
Just
is
in
that
case
the
you
bad
were
idea
wondering,
that it's over?
No, that's not the bad idea. It's not often that a town of roughly 1,000 people makes national news, but then it's not often that a town faces a plight so ripe for media attention Alabama, for upwards of 2 months, y'all. A train brimming with sewage sludge has been squatting uninvited near fields used for youth baseball, simmering in the afternoon sun,
gross.
Making its noisome presence known even in the darkness of night.
Oh, no. I smell it from here.
Yes. In a word, Mayor Heather Hall told the Associated Press earlier this week, quote, "It smells like death."
But we have the name.
The smell of death.
Like death. Yeah.
The sweet smell of death.
No, it's not a sweet smell. But it appears that the tiny town may finally be waking from a long nightmare. I have wonderful news, Hall announced Wednesday on Facebook in what one might just describe as a remarkable understatement. She explained that the containers of excrement aboard the train had been transported to and emptied at their intended destination.
Oh, great.
The landfill operated by Big Sky Environmental, about 25 miles away. A few containers remained at the parish rail yard as of Wednesday afternoon, but she reassured her constituents that these were just empty, soon to be removed as well. But one might reasonably ask, as I did, some 250 tractor trailer loads, about 10 million pounds of doing just sitting in a residential area. The more mathematically minded among you have probably already noted that that comes out to roughly 5 tons of poop per capita in parish. Which is why I love this article. Hats off to the writer.
I've never wondered more literally what the shit.
As NPR's Jacob Pinter pointed out earlier this month, the stuff in question comes from New York and New Jersey.
Oh, God.
Which, to resolve complications with local regulations, often avoids those regulations entirely by shipping their waste across state lines to areas with looser zoning laws. At least that is where the poo in parish hails from, though it has taken somewhat of a circuitous route to get there, Dennis Pillen of AL.com reported. He notes that the train came to parish earlier this year after getting blocked by Jefferson County, Alabama, where it had originally planned to transfer its contents to trucks for the last leg to the landfill. So instead, the containers just sat in parish and sat and sat.
Civilization.
Under the burning sun.
Yes. In the end, it took a little over 2 months for the material to leave parish, Hall said Wednesday. She added her thanks to those who aided their quest to get the matter resolved, but noted that her town situation is not unique. Quote, "While what happened in parish was, to our understanding, an unprecedented event, there are still small towns like parish fighting the situation on a smaller scale," she said.
Oh my God.
"I will say this over and over. The material does not need to be in a populated area, period. It greatly diminishes the quality of life for those who live anywhere near it." And she asked lawmakers to pay more attention to regulating the problem. Quote, if there had been even a small amount of oversight, this might not have happened. So, this is a doozy of an idea.
I didn't even know sewage went on trains.
Yeah, I didn't either. Right.
Like when you see a train pass, is that what can be in it? Wow.
I don't know. But you have, I'm going to put 15 minutes on this clock and you can trains, planes, automobiles, whatever you want to do with it. Your time starts now.
Yeah. I am flabbergasted at the patience of the people of this town of being able to deal with it for 2 months, because I think that after one day, if I were mayor, it would have been nuke it from orbit.
Right.
But sir, this will demolish a third of the town. Worth it. Yeah.
So what I found really interesting was when the mayor was talking and she was like, This shouldn't be in this small town. And it was very much like in my mind was this like big, like it's from New York and to this like small town in Alabama. So that like conflict was really interesting. I was almost thinking like Aaron Brockovich or like something like that. Or I was thinking it could be like more like conceptual, like set in the future of like, this is, we now are like shipping this waste to like
Mars or whatever.
Or like
Nebulon
people
5.
Or like, or even just like communities that don't have as much money or like something like that. So that's where my mind went.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of a like a David and Goliath clash about like where things are okay to leave
and like class systems.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
I am amazed that you were able to come up with something so concrete so quickly about the story, because I'm still honestly in shock. I'm just kind of like,
well, one thing, of course, it's from New Jersey. Like,
I know, I had that thought. I was like, of course, it's from New York and New Jersey. Oh my God. And it went so far. And Alabama was this?
This was in Alabama, yeah.
Jesus. Alabama.
Like, how many train cars? I don't, I'm just
the question, yeah.
Yeah.
And just like those poor souls who have to, like, it, you know, the New York City's sewage and water board have to transfer like sewage waste sludge in onto a train. Like, that's a bad job too.
Yeah. And then someone has to drive that train.
Someone has to drive
that
train.
And it was in the heat, right?
Yes. So it was like standing in the sun. I can think of few things that are more repulsive. Near where Little League was supposed to be.
No. Oh my God. Yeah.
So like, I'm wondering if there's like a place to take this that is not totally unlike, I was going to say Star Wars, but it also starts with S. I'm just thinking like the Empire and their like Death Star needed to be destroyed. Now I'm just imagining that like the Empire of New York and like, mm-hmm, I guess like large urban areas just being like a shit line under the rest of like the surround. Like, I'm just imagining rebels needing to like take down the poop train.
They're really
like protect their homes.
Yeah. Right.
There is something very Hunger Games about this. Of kind of, you know, like District 4 or whatever gets to deal with kind of like all the waste from the capital.
Yeah.
Right.
And it may not be sort of just sort of like excrement, but kind of like all of their waste. And just, mm-hmm, sort of like the way that like all the districts had sort of, this is the one where they get the lumber, and this is the one where they get kind of like this
resource.
Yeah, the resource.
Fish, and like the District 12 is where they get like the coal, right, or whatever.
Because, mm-hmm, efficiency is a virtue, people.
Right, right, exactly. There might be sort of, you know, one that is specifically kind of the crap hole.
And, and why would that, like, why is it in that place? Like, what's the like history behind it being sent there? I think that if there is going to be like this Hunger Games idea, and maybe like, it'd probably lead to like a rebellion, right? Of so like, why? What would be
the rebellion?
Not going to take this ship anymore.
I know there could be so many good like picket sides, but yeah, like what? Why was it sent there in the first place?
Like, my sort of stab at it would be that to get like real colonial about it.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Like, say, like 500 years ago when the empire first showed up, or the people of the capital, or whatever the sort of, you know, ruling class showed up. This was maybe a district that was very rich in diamonds, or sort of something that had to be excavated. There was sort of like riches underneath the earth.
Right.
And now, 300, 400 years later, those are all gone. Like, they've been completely mined out. But what is left with is sort of a very, very extensive, like, underground cave and tunnel network.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's just one of these things that, for a lot of the time, this was kind of the center of commerce and the center of riches and kind of the great...
But very exploitative.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Right, right.
Because, like, mine conditions throughout history, not great.
Exactly. Yep. And now that it's one of these, like, well, the riches are all gone now. So now the sort of mine exploitation can stop, and then the empire's kind of going like, no, now you get to fill it all back
it
up
out.
Yeah,
mm-hmm, you can fill it up.
Right, like that would sort of be my guess at how this place ended up being sort of the refuse pile,
right,
for the empire.
I like that. Yeah, and and just thinking about it from like an environmental standpoint, that if you are then like filling it back up, like,
with
what is
feces.
That? Yeah, like, what does that do to like the geography of it, and like the
probably some sinkholes.
Yeah. Oh, some.
I'm wondering. Agriculture is going to be real good in that neighborhood.
Like, in about 400 more years. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. On a long enough timeline, would the poop be compressed back into diamonds or something?
Maybe that's like what they're saying. They're like, no, we're just like
No, and like probably. If this is sort of a science fiction story, they would have like maybe some sort of technology to try and do like speed up the process of making.
Oh my God.
Except I don't think so. Except I think that this would be sort of a very poor, undereducated district.
Yeah, totally.
They would get told the lie of kind of like everything that we're doing is environmentally sound and environmentally safe.
Mm.
And really, it's just a landfill.
Yeah.
And it like has been like kind of like people have been able to like survive, live, but now. Like the the drop could be that it's starting to like
affect people.
Yeah, like there's a sinkhole, a horrible sinkhole, and like
the kids all have asthma,
a school gets like engulfed in or like something like that, and this is when they're starting to,
I'm flashing back to that episode with the Shitterton town where people kept stealing the sign.
Oh God, yeah.
This is
crossover.
Much more literal version of that.
Yeah.
And then so there's a.
But yeah, but then there's like sort of a big hush up operation.
Yeah.
And then the locals are trying to expose what's actually happening here to, you know, the folks in the capital who, let's just make them New York and New Jersey. And they're you know, probably very cosmopolitan minded and would be horrified about this if they knew. But there's a certain amount of like conscious not knowing that they're engaged in.
And probably the main two characters would be sort of one local to the district.
Yeah.
And maybe like a reporter from the capital that shows up and kind of realizes the great lie that both the capital and the district have been told of kind of, no, hang on a second. Right. Like, you know, this is, oh God, it's basically sort of Wally of kind of, you know, like everyone kind of lives under the fiction of the sort of like, you know, environmental restoration process is taking place. And really, it's just kind of just pack it in and get it underground and stop thinking about it.
Yeah.
Or there could be like a whistleblower from like within the, like some like train driver or someone who like works for it or something like that.
Yeah, someone who is sort of a conscientious objector within the government, blows the whistle. Is suppressed, and then you have a reporter come down to try and assess the truth of it.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's like a sort of homegrown hero story of like somebody who was maybe able to test into the, you know, the Citadel University.
Sure, sure.
And who coming back after years of being part of the upper echelons of society realizes that mom and pop have been screwed over systemically.
Right.
And it's time to set things right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great.
Once the rebellion is in full swing, or the guerrilla or the resistance or whatever it is, I want one of the things that they do is to kind of damage the tracks leaving the Citadel so that one of the big refuse trains gets stuck in like within the capital, like in the two hottest weeks of the year, and just like, you know, like the sun bearing down upon it.
Oh man.
Just sort of like
that's the question. I think that's a great set piece. The question I have is how we get from sort of a uncovering corruption story to rebellion, because those are not necessarily the same trajectory.
Right.
Yeah.
I feel like you do like compressed time up style intro. That's like the family in this rural place, you know, doing something in a mine that seems stinky, but we don't know exactly what, and like. This like one bright shining, just like their daughter is like, you know, sort of making her way out of the village and into the, you know, wider world of the Citadel. And then, sort of winds down with them discovering just exactly what is happening in this town. And maybe where it was a rosy childhood is now a stinking backwater.
Right.
And then so the reveal is just immediately hit, and that's kind of the inciting incident. Is like, oh, I see what's happening here, we need to do something about it. And then it's like, I think some point into act two we can start to get into rebellion mode.
Yeah. And I think, Sarah, that there can be sort of an aspect of they may be joining an ongoing rebellion rather than starting one. Like there might already be sort of this.
That's probably a wise adjustment. Yeah.
Yeah.
Tom Zarek from Battlestar Galactica sort of figure of someone that for years has kind of been going, we need new government. We need radical change. We need revolution.
Right.
The government is like, this is undesirable element number one.
Yeah.
And there's sort of this dynamic of kind of a lot of people see him as sort of this freedom fighter, this kind of figure that will lead us to a better future. And a lot of other people are kind of going like, yeah, but he's real power hungry. He's, you know, like, sure, he'll do that, but that's not why he's doing it.
Yeah.
And he's probably sort of very much like both. And then sort of the people of this refuse pile district have to kind of, you know, sort of make the hard choice of, well, how are we going to get chained? Are we going
to
do sort of the...
Are we going to trust this Pancho Villa-like figure? Or
are we going to... Kids' Rebellion.
Ooh.
You know, there are those marches.
Yeah.
There are, yeah.
Get the ragtag group.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But yeah, but I think that it's... That's going to be a hard choice at a certain point of kind of, are you doing the kind of grassrootsy, more within the means of the law thing? Or are you kind of hitching your wagon to this much more radical figure?
Well, you have about 2 minutes, 56 seconds to answer that question.
Okay.
oh, so much pressure.
We also have like not talked at all about who is the main
character. That may be a good question to answer.
What I'm wondering now.
Zach kind of got into a little bit of the like, is it the homegrown hero that...
Right. That's one direction. But we could also go the... We were talking about maybe a journalist. I feel like there's a lot of different possibilities. Does anyone stand out to anyone here?
I kind of like the someone coming back and... Because they've kind of seen, they have that perspective now of seeing like, oh no, this is literal crap that we are living in. And then coming back and like trying to get people into this idea that like things need to change. But then the people that live there, they're like, oh, I don't know, we've been living like this for so long. And then that, I think that has like a really good conflict.
Yeah, there's a tension there.
Yeah.
Just like. Yeah. Traditional sort of set in your ways of life, kind of existence versus, you know, sort of a progress at all costs kind of a thing.
Yeah. And they could, that character could then go, like, they would have some like tough choices to make. Like if they're like, okay, I do want to like follow this person, but they're doing shady stuff. So that idea of like walking the line of like morality versus like what is good for like the overall.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do they win in the end?
Probably, but a kind of very sort of like Pyrrhic victory.
Yeah.
It probably kind of ends in sort of like one of those places of like, you know, winning is easy, governing is harder of kind of, you know.
Right.
Well, you could stop the trains, but if you do that, then, you know, sort of this segment of society is not going to be able to deal with it, and so like the industry is going to have to wind down. That's going to leave these people without a job. That's going to cause economic problems. That
also
means that these people are going to starve over here.
We heard you like Netflix.
Uh-huh.
Shunk off button. Like, I don't know, I'm just like thinking like where they get their
like the government you would probably end up with a much more fragmented society because the ways that we interconnect with each other favor some people over, like, there are winners and losers to all of that.
Yeah.
Well, any thoughts in the last 20 seconds?
What's it called?
Shitstorm. No.
That's pretty great.
Yeah. Well, there's something about like, you know, like
there's so many possibilities.
Yeah, like we're not gonna take this crap anymore or something like that. But Shitstorm is a lot better.
Well, that is time.
Oh my God.
That was so funny.
Jesus Christ, Sarah.
What an idea.
I mean, you see some things. Like, there are some, we talk about this amongst ourselves sometimes, of like, there, you read articles like, maybe this would work. This could be interesting. But you see something like that, and
you're
well,
like, yes.
Yeah.
I'm done.
Like 100%.
Gold star.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that was great.
Well, we will be back. Hopefully with more gold stars and less shit after this break.
And welcome back, everybody. We are here for another installment that we don't get to do as often these days and is always a joy, of just talking about creativity. And specifically today, just what does it take to write a novel?
a subject that I am very, very interested in right
intrigued.
Now as I wrestle with a novel of my own.
So it's weird because now that I'm working on a second project, I'm like, how on earth did I, like, how do I have a finished book? Like, mm-hmm. how did I ever do this? Mm-hmm. And I think that the main thing is I just worked on it every single day. Like, I would wake up and I would work on it for like 2 or 3 hours and then like go about my day. Obviously, there were times when I spent a lot more time on that during a day. But generally, just like when people ask me for advice about like, oh, I need to write a novel, I'm just like, keep going. Don't stop. And eventually, hopefully one day it'll be done. But I think I was really lucky in the sense that the first half of the novel was my master's thesis at Emerson. Mm. So I had this like very strict deadline. Like I needed a chapter done in 2 weeks. I needed the next chapter done. So I had these very like strict deadlines or else I wouldn't graduate.
Right.
So I kind of had to, yeah. So I kind
There's
of
that
had to,
fear.
Yeah. And then like my thesis advisor being like, when are we going to get new pages? And I'm like, oh, okay.
Soon. Yeah.
So I was really lucky in that sense. And then when I graduated, I just gave myself a deadline and I was mm-hmm. like, I'm just going to keep going on this schedule until I finish it. And I finished the first draft actually like on my 28th birthday, I think.
Wow.
I like woke up and I did it and I was like, oh, that was the last line. And it was actually like a lot of the process was terrifying as well. Like I would wake up like scared because I didn't know the end of the novel until I wrote it.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Wow.
And lots of times when I'm writing a story, I'll like know the end. Like with a short story, I usually like have the end in mind, but with this, I had no idea. So I just had to trust that I would find the end mm-hmm. at some point. And then when I wrote it, I was like,
oh,
okay,
there it is.
This is it. And I just like sat there just kind of like baffled, and then I went to work and I was like, okay. So yeah, it was a lot of just not stopping, basically.
Wow.
Yeah.
And in terms of finding that ending, do you sort of feel like you sort of suddenly just kind of like understood something, just kind of like, oh, that's what it is? Or do you sort of feel like it was kind of a lot of mental trial and error and simulating different things and kind of going, that's not it, that's not it, that's not it?
I think that happened a lot more in the beginning for probably the first half, really just like setting up the story and figuring out like exactly who the characters were. So that happened a lot more probably with the first half of the book. And then the second half, I kind of like knew like everyone's like motivations, ideas, like what they were after. So I just kind of like followed that in through the end. So the end came like I wrote it pretty quickly, like compared to the beginning of it where I was just doing I write everything longhand. So like a lot of it would just be like, yeah, it takes forever.
No, hats off.
So a lot of it was just like scribbling about like I have boxes of notebooks that like those words obviously never made it into the novel, that scene never made it into the novel,
right.
It was just me like figuring out these characters.
I'm a very big believer in kind of everything that you take off the page stays on the page.
Yes,
because it
exactly.
informs your writing from that point onwards.
Some of my friends who are writers like think that my process is like a little too much because I won't even like look at a draft when I like redraft.
So you want to recreate it based on your idea of it.
So I picture it as like this huge like hole that I'm just like filling in with dirt mm-hmm. and then the like grass is what you see. So like I put all the dirt there and I filled it up, but then it's only like the top that you actually see. But everything else is necessary there. Yeah, but sometimes I'm like, oh, I wish I wrote faster. Like, hurry, this takes forever. But I don't know. It's just what works for me. So, yeah.
I hear that if it works, you shouldn't fix it.
Yeah, I know. Sometimes I do try to rush it. And then I'm just like, oh, I guess I just wasted time doing that.
Yeah, that is the that is an incredibly annoying thing, is like if you try and sort of buck or change to go faster, often it's just not, you just waste time trying to take a shortcut.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm just like really big on deadlines. I set myself deadlines. I have at least like four friends where I set them deadlines for their writing.
Mm-hmm. Really?
I'll be like, you're gonna, one friend, I even schedule her like writing time. Like, I'll be like, okay, you write best at night, so like, tell me what days you're free this week. And I put it on her Google calendar. I'm
just, that's
like,
a true friend.
Yeah. I'm just like, you're gonna write. And obviously I'm like, there's no, I'm not gonna be mad if you don't write.
Right.
But sure. She's like, no,
I'll just be disappointed.
Yeah. I know. I'll just be disappointed. No. So she's like, no, I feel that like accountability to do it. So, yeah.
Have you always been sort of the kind of person who's good about doing things consistently every day and having like consistent writing time? Or is that a skill that you've had to build?
I think that when I have like a project that I'm doing, I'm really good at it. But if I don't, I can get a little more just like, oh, I'll work on it tomorrow. Like, I kind of have this idea.
Right.
But I think that part of the reason I went to grad school, because I took 4 years off and I worked. Part of the reason I went back to grad school, because I was like, I know this is going to like make me make that schedule, make me have these projects that I want to be working on. And also just, I was a marketing writer, so I'd be writing all day, and then I didn't want to, I wanted nothing to do with words at the end of the day.
That makes all the sense.
Yeah. So it's kind of been a practiced habit for sure.
I'm just flashing back to how I lost making videos for myself and making videos for money.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm curious, you mentioned accountability buddies. I'm wondering, how did you, because I know that's something that I think in college I tried and we'd fall off, or I know as we've sort of had live streams with people who've been asking for advice, like how did you go about like building that community? And is there anything that you think is sort of accessible for somebody who's just like looking for that sort of structure and maybe isn't thinking about or able to do grad school?
Yeah. So I have a writing group from people that I went to grad school with, but I think like there are writing groups all over, like they're where you can just like go and you like sit down and you like write with people. But, and also anytime someone like mentions like a creative, I'm the annoying one where I'm like, oh my God, let's like swap pages. And then I'm the like annoying one in the situation, but because I know that it's helping me too.
Right.
So like I have a friend from grad school and he has a book coming out in January. Excuse me. And he was in one of my novel workshops, and he's like this person who's a great writer, but he like procrastinates so much. And so I was like, oh,
an alien concept to all of us.
And I was like, oh, you want to finish this novel? I want to finish my novel. Let me like be really annoying and set these deadlines for you. And I set it for myself too.
Right.
So I think that just like anyone that you know that like has this like creative drive, and it just like saying like, okay, like let's swap stuff, let's like meet up for 2 hours someday and like just talk about it, is just really important, because I think lots of people want to do it. Like the people, like all my friends are always like, yeah, I like really want to work on this project, and I'm just like, okay, let's do it, let's make it happen, let's just start now. I guess. Yeah, it is nice though, also because then I know that I'm not like alone in this process, and I know that like my friend, he's working on his second book too, and so we're both going through this like a very similar idea of being like, okay, like can we do this again? Like, do we want to do this again? Like, we're having so much trouble, but like having that like camaraderie is really important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are you finding are the biggest differences between kind of writing the first book and writing the second book? Yeah. Like, kind of what are the things that have most changed?
So it's a completely different style of writing than I have really ever done before.
Mm. That's exciting.
And it, so Tinfoil Crowns is a young adult novel. This new book is adult. It's an adult novel, and it's a collection of like linked short stories, and just like the narration is even really different. Mm. And like the voice and the like concepts are like very, very different. So it's a completely new project. So part of it is like really exciting to be working on something so different, but part of it is also like, oh, I'm starting like from square one. This is completely different than the first book. Like sometimes I'm like relearning how to tell a story in this like new project format that I'm doing. So basically what I'm just keeping telling myself, I'm like, okay, I finished one book. That should give me faith that I can finish another.
Right.
But, you know, sometimes that doesn't always work.
No, I think that we get a lot of that of kind of, we did sort of a big audio fiction project.
Yeah.
And I think that once that was over, I at least sort of definitely kind of went into the next big audio fiction thing that we did as kind of this like, this will be a cinch. Like, we already did that last one. And then all of a sudden like, oh, no, right. I now need to
You're different.
Yeah, yeah. You're different. You know, just because I, you know, figured out how to talk to all those characters doesn't mean that I immediately know how to talk to these characters. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how this moves. I don't know how this kind of like behaves.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's kind of a relearning experience every single time.
Absolutely. Yeah. And just like also relearning, but also like new imposter syndrome.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Like, this is renewed too. I mean, even though that never went away, but like, oh, this is, am I qualified to do this? Yeah.
Right. And also just sort of comparing, like, at least for me, like benchmarks of past performance, like, you idiot, you've written 70 pages in a day before. Why are you staring at like seven?
Yeah.
Well, it's because by that point you had so much muscle memory about how to write for the setting of those 70 pages.
Right.
Yeah. Getting back into like the swing of things is definitely like, it is like muscle memory. So I was teaching full time over the summer, which was kind of nice because after like going on book tour, like doing all like the launch press for it, I was kind of just like, I need to get away from all this for a little bit. So I didn't have the like really structured writing schedule that I was used to. So now these past like 3 or 4 weeks, now that I'm back in Boston, back in like my normal schedule, I've had to like relearn the like really long lengths of writing. Like I would find time here and there to write over the summer, but now it's like, oh, I need to sit down for like 3 hours today and write. And I haven't done that in a while.
Yeah.
But it's practicing.
What have you been finding works in that practice? Like, I found that for myself and for a lot of people I talk to, the hardest thing is getting started.
Yeah.
Do you have any cheats, hacks, desperate measures, break glass in case of?
Yeah. So sometimes I'm like really stubborn when it comes to like, I don't think I've ever had like writer's block, but when it comes to this idea of just like having a tough day, I'll just write like garbage and be kind of okay with it, just knowing that like I have to sit down for like 3 hours. Or even if I like keep getting distracted and I'll like be looking at my window, I'll be like, I know that I'm gonna sit here for like at least 3 hours today. And I'm also really big on routine. So the night before, I'll like, when I'm like getting really kind of overly into it, I'll like put the notebook there and I'll be like, okay, I know what I'm gonna be working on in the morning. I'll like wake up, have my routine in the morning, and then like sit down and kind of like go. So having this routine, just like getting into the habit and just like making yourself sit there, like even if you're just sitting in the chair for like 3 hours, I think that's something that you are like, because it's hard. Like that's, I think, one of the hardest things about writing is just like sitting down and actually doing it.
It's kind of a terrifying thing.
Yeah. And also like having a blank page is really scary. So I kind of like stopping in the middle of like an idea or like a scene or something, because then I'll have that to go back to the next morning and just like really quickly get myself into it. So I don't have that time of just like my wheels spinning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I definitely feel like there's been a theme, at least in some of the podcasts I listen to around creativity, of aspiring to be the person doing the thing versus the person having done the thing.
Yeah.
Like the person who is just like going to sit there for 3 hours today and did it yet, you know, just mm-hmm. like sort of the non-glamorous side of it versus the like finished product, oh, which yeah. is very appealing.
But. And there's even like writers that talk about, I hate writing. I love having written.
Yeah. Right. That is me in a nutshell.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that also part of, so in like grad school, at one point I had this like, not epiphany, but I was just like, oh, I will probably like just keep writing forever. And that kind of made me less scared about writing, because mm-hmm. I think in grad school, a really big thing, I'm happy that I went and got my MFA. It's not for everyone, and I don't like suggest it for everyone. Mm-hmm. It's not necessary to write a book to go get your MFA. But I think that a lot of people in the MFA were like, I need to get published. I need to get published. Like, sure. I need to have this book deal. Like, I need to do this. And I think that by focusing on that, you're not really focusing on the work to get there. So then like one day I was just like sitting there and I was like, oh, I like actually really do like the process of writing, even when it sucks, even when mm-hmm. it is like not fun. Like it is kind of, I want to be in that process. And that really took a lot of the pressure off of myself, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of like freed up some emotional space to just be like, okay, I'm just like focusing on this process. So like thinking of the work, not thinking of like, oh, I want to go on book tour and do all this. And like, yeah. yes, I would love for it to be successful. But like, I'm in the end, if I'm going to be spending like 3 to 4 hours every single day working on this, like I have to enjoy that time. So yeah. that was a big moment, I think, for me. Then I didn't even realize it until like a few years later. I was like, yeah, I just like had this idea one day. And I was like, oh, yeah, that was a big idea. That was like a big thought that I had. So that's like what I just try to remind myself of, like just sitting there doing the work, the process, like being in the process of it.
I love that. That's I definitely, when anybody asks for creative advice or like how to get that, I just sort of jump to imagine the worst day in this project and think about what seat you want to be in, yeah. in that, it, like, what is your heaven in this hell?
Yeah, yeah.
Of like, yeah, I like make that. Bring something out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's not, and it is good to like be able to like talk with people about it, like to know that even though it does seem like, oh, it's only me that has having this like struggle with it, it's like every right. writer goes through that. Like every creative person deals with this in some way. So, and I also, when I write, I started like watercoloring. So it's like nice to Ooh. Like have that creativity to like not with words. So mm-hmm. that like, I think yeah. having like something of a break, like giving your mind a mental break is like important too.
Right.
Yeah. No, that's the thing. I often like wish I was more creative artistically mm-hmm. and like a better artist, because it's so relaxing to go from sort of one side of creativity to another. And yeah. then you come back weirdly refreshed and maybe with like a different focus that's useful.
Yeah. And I have a friend that she went to school for like some really specific type of art. I think it was like charcoal or I don't know. But we were like sitting down, like drawing one day, and she was getting so frustrated oh. at it. And it would just like remind me, I was like, oh, this is my like, that's like writing for me, like how seriously she takes drawing is like how seriously I take mm. writing. So I was just like sitting here like watercoloring, and she was just like, no, I need this to be perfect. And I was like, oh, okay, that's because this is your like number one art. I was like, this is just like whatever, I'm like doodling. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, everybody, I think that is all the time that we have for this episode of No Bad Ideas. But thank you so much for joining us, Erin. It's been,
thank you for having me.
No, it's been so much fun. Absolute to pleasure. Have you.
This was so fun.
Good.
This was great.
So where should people go to find out more about your work and all the things that you're up to?
Yeah, so I have a Twitter, JonesE9. Mm-hmm. I don't have a website. I know I need one. I know I need an author website. So for times like this, I can be like, yeah, go look at like my author website. So my best friend put a page on her website.
Oh my God. That's amazing. Great.
And it literally just says like my friend Eric. And you like click on it. And so that's the link in my Twitter bio. It has like where you can that's find the incredible. Book. You can get the book.
Amazing.
From Flux, the publisher. They're a great publisher.
That's true friendship.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It's like, oh, it made me so happy because it was like stressing me out. Like,
is this the person that you schedule writing time?
Oh my God. That's so awesome.
Yeah. So she was just like, okay, I know this is really stressing you out. Like, I'm just going to put this on. You can eventually make your own website, but here is this. So that has like all the links for where you can find it from Flux, and you can buy it from Amazon too. And then at local independent bookstores.
Indeed, indeed, indeed.
Amazing.
That's what I always push for. Yeah. But yeah, Jonesy9, I mainly like tweet about my mom and like the stars and like planets and stuff. So,
all the good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Eventually there's like once in a while there's a writing thing in there. But most of the time it's like my mom or like the moon, basically.
Well,
yeah,
I'm definitely going to.
Yeah, no, that sounds great.
And you all should definitely sign up too. And you all should definitely come back for another episode of No Bad Ideas next week.
This has been No Bad Ideas, produced by Gabrielle Urbina, Sarah Shackett, and Zach Valenti. Many thanks to our patrons for their partnership in making this show happen. And a special shout out to our idealist member, Rena Sarame. Today's episode features music by State Shirt and Jazar from freemusicarchive.org. You can support the show at patreon.com/nobadideas. And if you love the show, please leave a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Thanks. See you next week.